This is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. Hello, everybody. How we doing? Today, we've got a scientist who is going to thoroughly dismantle the widely held belief, one that you may harbor yourself, that the only way to succeed is to kick your own ass. One of the many things I like about Dr. Serena Chen, who's a professor of psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, is that she initially approached self-compassion quite skeptically. She is now, however, one of the leading researchers in the field. And in this conversation, we talk about the definition of self-compassion, the difference between self-compassion and self-esteem, the studies that show that self-compassion leads to more desire for self-improvement and increased authenticity. And she lays out some self-compassion exercises that you can easily fit into your daily life. Self-compassion has been huge for me personally in my own life. It's actually a major focus of the book I've spent many, many years working on, which hopefully will come out next year. So anyway, this is a subject that's very important to me. I approached it with a lot of skepticism, but I'm now a full-on convert. Let me just say before we dive in, this is the first part in a week-long series we're doing here on the show on self-compassion. Coming up on Wednesday, we're going to talk to a great meditation Dharma teacher, Afosu Jones-Korte, about how to rewire your inner dialogue. But today, it's Dr. Serena Chen, and she is coming right up. But first, some BSP. As you've heard me say before, the hardest part of personal growth, self-improvement, spiritual development, whatever you want to call it, the hardest part is forgetting. You listen to a great podcast, you read a great book, you go to a great talk, whatever it is, and the message is electrifying. But then you get sucked back into your daily routines, your habitual patterns, and you forget. So this is the problem for which I have designed my new newsletter, which we just started a few months ago, and we're just really hitting our stride. So I'd love it if you sign up. Every week, I list one quote that I'm pondering right now, and then I give you two of the top takeaways from the podcast this week. It's really for both me and for you to get these messages into our molecules. I'm just kind of mainlining the practical aspects of the episodes from the week and listing it out for you. And then I also list three cultural recommendations, books, movies, TV shows that I'm into right now. You can sign up. It's free. It's at danharris.com. That's my new website, danharris.com. Sign up for the newsletter. Meanwhile, over on the 10% Happier app, they're offering a special deal, 40% off the subscription price until the end of May. Head over to 10%.com/40 to get started. This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. I got to tell you, I feel so much better when I talk about my anxiety instead of keeping it bottled up. There's an expression that I first heard from the great researcher and also Zen practitioner Robert Waldinger, never worry alone. Our temptation many times is to keep it bottled up, but the data really show that the people who do the best in life, who live the longest and are the happiest, have strong relationships with people with whom they can talk about whatever's going on in their lives. And for me, therapy is part of that. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you might give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/happier today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/happier. As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. Dr. Serena Chen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Fun to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. From what I know of your biography, a pretty hard-nosed scientist and researcher. How did you get into self-compassion, which I'm a huge fan of? I'm totally sold on it, but I can imagine to some people, and maybe even to some of your colleagues, might have sounded a little gooey.
Well, I can't take credit for it. I had a graduate student, maybe 2008, 2009, who came to me and said, she introduced me to the concept of self-compassion. And I was the one who found it a little woo-woo, gooey, you know, choose your word for it, and just luxurious and not, you know, something I was certainly raised to practice, this notion of self-compassion. But I wanted to support my graduate students' interests, and so we dove in. It was related to the self, which is one of my primary areas of research. So I was game, you know, to support her and learn about this, try to keep an open mind. And it's been a great journey. I've learned so much, and I've gotten to do science on it, which has made me a complete convert, a believer. But it wasn't, I didn't start it. My graduate student, Yuli Brines, she's the one that came to me with this idea.
I'm curious to hear more about the impact of your life and why it didn't necessarily jibe with the way you were raised. But let me just ask a question that might be a little bit of a digression, but I can't help myself.
Okay.
When you say your area of interest was initially the self,
yeah.
What does that even mean?
Oh, okay. Well, I care about how people think about themselves. I care about how people evaluate themselves. And I really care a lot about how the social situation, in particular our close relationships, shape so much of who we are in a moment-by-moment basis, in a more chronic, stable basis. I mean, this is a very widely understood idea in psychology, as old as a discipline, that we are socially constructed beings. And a lot of my research takes that really seriously, that who I am is so bound up with the people around me, particularly the close others around me, like my mom, my best friend, romantic partner, what have you. So that's what I mean, like how people see themselves, how they evaluate themselves.
This notion that the self isn't some discrete entity, but is in fact socially constructed, to use what I believe were your words.
Yeah.
Doesn't that seem to point us in the direction of Buddhism in some way, which argues that, yeah, on some conventional level of reality, you are you, Serena, and I am Dan, but ultimately, there's no core nugget of self.
Yeah, it's just not the way I approach the study of this. I understand that. And I know there are perspectives like that. There's no self. I can't even wrap my head around that. Phenomenologically, there is a self. I mean, I think people can readily talk about who they are. I ask you who you are. People can go on and on and on for a long time. So for me, you know, staying on this, I don't know, secular day-to-day phenomenology level, there is a self. I'm not interested, by the way, in the self in like a capital S way, as if there is a true objective self out there. As a social psychologist, I care about what you think yourself is, because that's what's going to influence how you react to things, how you relate to people, the choices you make, what you think is yourself, whether others agree with you or not.
I won't drag you into a metaphysical debate about
the
self. But,
yeah.
But it's interesting to me that you might ask me, how do I think of myself? But I might not, for some people, I might not talk about, you know, my relationships. And yet what is true is that the self is socially constructed, but we may not see that aspect of ourselves.
Absolutely. I'm not saying that it's visible to us or in our conscious awareness in our day-to-day lives. And in fact, most people, especially in a culture like ours, which is Western individualistic, we're very into being independent entities. We don't want to admit or acknowledge at times how deeply we are shaped by the social context. So I, by no means am I saying I'm going around thinking this is true. But there's so many different theories in my field and related fields that shows, and just intuitively, we know the impact of, for example, caregivers like our parents or teachers or siblings, what have you, have had on shaping who we are. I mean, you know, so many theories about this, but it becomes invisible, and that's fine. I mean, it's not something I'm wedded to that people are necessarily aware of it. And the other thing I'll say is that if I ask you who you are, maybe not you, Dan, but a lot of other people like to think in terms of a self that is like pretty stable, continuous. I have a coherent sense of self as if that's who I am all the time. And yet we know in our day-to-day lives, who I am right now is not who I am with my 14-year-old when we're having a fight. I mean, these are very different selves that I am enacting. Okay, so we are constantly fluctuating who we are, at least outwardly, but we don't necessarily acknowledge that either.
But everything you're saying could be taken as an argument for the Buddhist notion
of self. That's fine. That's fine. Okay. But yes, that's fine. And I'm not studying that. I find it fascinating. I've started to read a bit about it. I have a colleague who's coming, whose spouse is very interested in this no self idea. So I have been reading a little bit about it. And I will confess, when I read about it, my head wants to explode because, of course, my whole career has been built on the existence of a phenomenological, at least, subjective self. So I'm not sure where I stand on that yet. I just know that people can readily talk about themselves. And, you know, I'm certainly one of thousands of researchers about the self and relatedly, our identities as part of, you know, social groups, like my identity as a professor, my identity as an Asian American, you know, I mean, those are real things to people in terms of influencing their behavior and so forth. Yeah.
I think the Buddhist view, to the extent that I can represent it faithfully, is both and.
Yeah.
All those things are true. Like on one level of reality, it is true. I can talk a lot about myself. I can also look in the mirror when I show up places. I have to show my driver's license, and that's all true.
Yes.
And the fact that I am a different person with my kid than I am with my boss.
Yeah.
And the fact that actually my sense of self, whether I know it or not, is constructed based on input from other people. It is, as I've once heard it called, dialogic. In other words, it's in a dialogue with other people all the time.
Yeah.
That points to another layer of reality that is true at the same time, which is I can't close my eyes and find a gift-wrapped, discreet Dan.
Yeah, no, that's so useful, level of reality. I am operating in my work and in my life thus far at the level of reality that I was talking about. But that doesn't mean that that other one can't exist. You're right. That's useful. Yeah.
Now that I've taken you down this primrose path, let's get back to self-compassion for a second. You said you found it woo-woo or gooey and that it wasn't the way you were raised. Tell me more about that. Like, what was behind that reaction? I'll say that I definitely had a negative first impression too. So I'm not asking this question from a position of judgment.
Yeah, no, I don't take it that way. I think partly culturally, East Asian collectivistically, but maybe more so just who I am. I was a much more self-critical versus self-compassionate sort of person. And wherever I picked it up from, I found it to be luxurious, too woo-woo to be so nice and warm and non-judgmental toward the self. Maybe because I come from the East Coast, got plopped down in Berkeley. It has been over 2 decades, so I'm over it now. But, you know, my parents, they were not hugely involved in terms of telling me what to do or my education or things like that. So they weren't the stereotypic tiger parents at all and telling me, you know, I need to get better grades or anything like that. So I think it was self-imposed, but I can't imagine them having said, be kind to yourself, Serena. it's comical to me. And it's not how, for example, my siblings raised their children. It's just not how we were raised at all. So it's felt very, to be honest, I am Chinese American, but it felt very American in addition to woo-woo, to be honest. But like I said, I mean, I'm pro well-being. I'm pro people feeling good about themselves in a way that is bound to reality. I'm pro, you know, having good relationships. I'm pro, obviously, good mental health and all those things self-compassion had potential to contribute to. And I'm pro supporting my graduate students' interests. And at that point, Kristen Neff and others had already started doing work on self-compassion. So there was beginning to be a literature, a scientific literature on the construct, which made me, you know, more comfortable to explore it.
For the uninitiated, Kristen Neff, Dr. Kristen Neff is at the University of Texas in Austin. She's been on the show many times. We'll put the links to those conversations in the show notes so you can go back and listen to them. She's been massively influential for me. And she really is like the godmother of self-compassion. But she's not here right now. So let me ask you the question I probably should have led with.
What is it?
Which is, what is self-compassion?
Yeah. I mean, I could certainly tell you about the different components. I've completely absorbed how Kristen Neff has theorized and conceptualized it. But speaking a little bit more broadly, you know, people can think about it as just a strategy, a way of thinking about the self, an emotion regulation strategy, all different ways to think about it. But to put it most simply, it's a way of treating the self in times where you're facing some sort of difficulty, a challenge, a failure, a setback. And this happens to the best of us, hopefully not all the time, but at some point in our lives, we're faced with things that are negative that happen to us that make us feel badly about ourselves. That's when self-compassion is relevant. And it involves three different elements, okay, according to Kristen Neff back in the early 2000s. She would argue, and we have all these data that support, that involves treating yourself kindly with warmth and non-judgment. So basically, let's say you didn't get a promotion at work, you're not going to berate yourself. You're going to be kind and understanding, just like you would if a friend came to you, called you up and said, oh my God, I didn't get this job. You would not judge them. You would be kind and understanding and listen to them. Self-compassion is directing that self, that kindness towards yourself. It also involves two other components. One is a sense of your similarity and connection to others in the sense that everybody experiences failure and setbacks at times. Okay, so something negative, something bad happens to you, you sort of recognize that this is a shared human experience. There's a common humanity here. So there's self-kindness, there's common humanity. And then there's something that Neff coined mindfulness. And mindfulness is used in many different contexts, and it's related in all these different contexts. In the context of a setback or negative event that feels terrible, somebody broke up with you. Again, you didn't get that job promotion. You failed the test. It is, you know, acknowledging the negativity. I feel bad. This sucks. You know, I didn't get the job. Somebody else did. It's acknowledging that, being mindful of it, facing it, not trying to deny it, not trying to make excuses and so forth. But at the same time, also approaching it emotionally with some level of balance, not getting overrun by the negativity. So you've got self-kindness, non-judgment, kindness, warmth. You've got, hey, I'm not alone. Everybody has made mistakes before. And I'm going to face this negative event. I'm going to allow myself to feel these crappy emotions, okay? But I'm not going to blow it out of proportion. I'm going to try to take a balanced perspective on it. Those three things together, and this is reflected in how it's typically measured in research on this, together, some components might speak to some people more than others, but they're really treated as sort of a package to reflect a self-compassionate response to something bad that happens.
I'm curious about the order of operations because you listed self-kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness in that order. For me, and this may be idiosyncratic,
yeah,
it would be the exact opposite.
Yeah, I could see that.
Nothing can happen until you're mindful and self-aware. And then maybe you bring to mind that right now, millions of other people worried about money or feeling rejected or whatever it is. And then you add in
You're absolutely right. And I can't believe, you know, I think it's a function of how the scale is described and the paper that describes the scale and how Kristen originally theorized about it, let's say in her probably most cited paper in 2003. But you're absolutely right. If you can't even sit in and acknowledge the negativity of the setback or failure, I mean, it is a first step. I didn't mean to imply anything by that these were sequential at all, but I can totally see your logic, although I've never thought about that before, to be honest. But yes, it requires that in some sense. Yeah. The mindfulness.
I call it the Neff three step. She doesn't like that, but yeah. You know, and the first step is waking up to the suckiness. You know, you have to, nothing can happen without that.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. You're right. It's funny. Why doesn't she like that? I'm surprised.
Oh, actually, I don't know if she doesn't like it, but she certainly hasn't taken it on as hers. Like, I think she wouldn't call it the Neff three step. She would call it a self-compassion break.
Yes.
I like giving her credit.
Yes. You know what? I think though, my guess is that for the regular person who doesn't talk jargon, like us researchers often slip into, I think self-kindness is the easiest to grasp. Be nice. Be nice to yourself, just like you would a friend. So if I had to guess, maybe that's why it comes first when people write about it. Huh. Because mindfulness is a little bit more abstract and vague to a lot of people, whereas be nice. Like, would you berate your friend? Would you say, you suck? No, you wouldn't do that. You would be like, you know, oh my God, I'm so sorry to hear that. You'd be kind and warm. So maybe that's why it's often talked about first. But I totally agree that it really requires at some level the mindfulness, the awareness, the acknowledgement, yeah.
I want to talk about some practices, and then I want to have a long discussion about your research. But before we do those things, just staying on the level of like definitions for a second, how would you distinguish self-compassion from self-esteem and self-love?
Well, I mean, self-esteem for sure. I mean, the two are correlated. You're high in self-compassion, you're high in self-esteem, and these are not small correlations, but they are really conceptually and empirically distinct, despite the high correlation between them. That is that they tend to go hand in hand. But self-esteem, which is a construct that's, you know, people love and it's been studied for decades and decades and decades, is about an evaluation of the self. And it's typically involves comparing yourself to others. There's a competitive element to it. We're all striving to have higher self-esteem. It's absolutely evaluative. It's a judgment about the self. How good or bad am I in whatever domain we're talking about or in general? Self-compassion is not a judgment at all. It's not an evaluation at all. It's a way of treating the self, of relating to oneself. There's no judgment involved, definitionally. So conceptually, they're absolutely different things in terms of one being an evaluation and judgment, the other expressly not being. This is not about evaluating the self. And the other thing that self-esteem typically connotes is you're comparing yourself to other people. You're trying to distinguish yourself from other people. It suggests a distancing from other people. Am I better or worse than you? In fact, the most often used measure for self-esteem has items that connote I'm better than you or I'm better than most other people. So it's very much comparative. Whereas self-compassion is really about drawing you closer to people, not comparing, emphasizing how we are similar, how we are all humans, we are connected. And these are really different concepts. And then empirically, the science bears this out. They're correlated, yes, because self-compassionate people tend to, because of what self-compassion does, have more favorable views of themselves, okay? But empirically, they predict different things. They have different correlates with other things. For example, self-esteem is correlated with narcissism positively. Self-compassion is not. But because of the fact that they go hand in hand, when we talk more about the science, you'll see in every study or every really good study, you measure self-esteem or you track self-esteem so that if you want to make claims about what self-compassion results in, you want to make claims that it results to something separate from any positive effects of self-esteem. So we empirically demonstrate that the effects of self-compassion are unique to self-compassion, don't have to do with its overlap with self-esteem. Does that make sense or is that too?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Yeah, self-love. Like, I actually don't know what the formal definition of self-love is, honestly. I can guess based on the words self-love. So I'm just going to take it at face value that it's feeling its acceptance of the self in a deep, stable, genuine way, but tell me if I'm wrong. It's not this literature I actually know, and I don't know anyone who works in that literature per se. It might be too woo-woo. I'm just joking a little bit. But I think that there's definitely overlap. But to me, it sounds still like self-evaluation to some degree versus talking about a way to cope with negativity and relate to yourself, how you treat yourself. But I am positive, without even knowing what the technical definition of self-love is, they're correlated, because self-compassion promotes acceptance, genuine self-worth, which, you know, sure sounds like what self-love would be about.
Yeah, well, I was actually at a conference a few months ago with Kristen Neff, and we were taking a walk to go to dinner together, and I was running this theory. I have a theory that I'm going to run by you, and I was running it by her. And I have a visual of the walk, but I don't remember what she said about whether I'm full of shit or not. But so with the caveat that I am not an academic and I've done no research on anything, I kind of think of love as the overarching term that would include under it compassion, kindness, understanding, friendliness, delight in other people's success. Yeah, so I'll leave it at that. So I think of self-compassion as a flavor of self-love.
Huh.
And it's the kind of self-love that you direct toward yourself when things are hard. But there is also self-love that you could just have at any regular 3 o'clock on a Tuesday.
Yeah. I'm not going to call that full of shit. It doesn't sound ludicrous to me. I don't know how data would bear that out. It'd be really hard. These things are all going to be really correlated. At first, when you said this, I was thinking about love as sort of the big love that you want to put at the top, as sort of a non-ego kind of thing. Like it's not about self-protection or self-inflation or boosting the self in relation to self. But of course, love, there's, you know, love toward other people. Yeah, so, but something about putting the ego aside, both when it comes to how you treat yourself with love and how you treat other people, you know, to be able to be there truly for other people and to love other people. I mean, there's a deep other-orientedness, a genuine other-orientedness that has to be there, which, you know, puts their interests before yours. And the other thing that came to mind, I can't help but think about authenticity, which I care so deeply about in general, self-compassion is not unrelated to it. I don't know. It came to mind too as this overarching construct too, but I'd have to think about it more. But it's not ludicrous in my mind.
Well, that's good, because see, I honestly, what I hope for when I advance a theory, the best I hope for is not ludicrous.
yeah, it's not in left field. Yeah, it's not on left field. No. You know, I'm going to Google self-love and see what the hell is out there in the science on this. Yeah, but boy, does it has woo-woo, dripping with woo-woo. But okay, yeah.
Well, I like to take things like that. You know, my first book was about meditation, which at that time, 10 years ago, that word was dripping with tough connotations.
And it still is in some places, a lot of places, yes.
So that's what I'm going for with love and self-love especially. So
got it.
Coming up, Dr. Serena Chen talks about the connection between self-compassion and authenticity or realness. And she talks about some self-compassion exercises that you can do on the daily and in a free-range fashion. Doesn't take a lot of ceremony. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected after investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns. T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile. Third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans. I'm a big fan of athleisure. I might have mentioned this before. As you know, I have the great privilege of working from home. So sweatpants, sweatshirts, comfortable t-shirts, I'm in the market for all of those things, especially when the price is right. And I've been turned on recently to a company called Quince, and I've been wearing a bunch of their stuff. If you watch the YouTube version of this show, you will probably see it. They have high quality pieces that never go out of style that you will be wearing year after year. They've got all the seasonal must-haves, like 100% European linen shirts from $30, performance polos and versatile flow knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. I was padding around the house last night in my Quince sweatpants. They look good, they feel good, and it's good to know that they're produced ethically. I'm all in. Upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/happier for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/happier to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/happier. Before we get back to the show, a quick reminder, in honor of World Meditation Week, we're offering 40% off a subscription to the 10% Happier app. Head over to 10%.com/40. That's 10% spelled out .com/40 to get started. Just to get back to one thing you said there, actually two things I want to get back to. One is you're talking about, you know, other love, other directed love, and it being, you know, egoless in some ways. I think a true holistic understanding of self-love would see that it feels so good to be attentive to other people.
Yeah.
That you would do it more often.
So you're saying you're still getting something out of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay. That's okay. I didn't mean it that way. I mean, that's a whole debate one could have is, you know, doing something for someone else, genuine or true, if you also gain from it. I think that's great, actually. It works. You know, it's a win-win, those kinds of situations. So I didn't mean it in that strict sense. So maybe I mean that other people's needs need to matter as much as your own. And if you get something out of it, that's great. That's great that you value that. So yeah, so that's a complicated thing. You know, it's always talked about in relation to altruism, for example, right? I don't have an issue with that. I think I like to think of it as a win-win. As long as, you know, it's not motivated for just the self-gain.
It gets back to this Buddhist thing that we're talking about at the beginning, because the line between self and other is so blurry.
Yeah.
That in some ways the whole debate doesn't make sense from seen from one angle.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you're challenging me here, dude. I want to be munching on this for days, okay? Yeah.
Self-love, I know in the past I have Googled the literature on this, and I can't swear by this, but my memory, which is always faulty, is that there's not much. Self-compassion is getting all the airtime.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, there's not much. And it's not going to be, I mean, apologies in advance to those who work on it, if there are ones. I can't imagine that it's particularly rigorous, to be honest. It's going to be a lot of correlational stuff of whatever is out there, which is great as a start. But, you know, I'm in the business of trying to establish cause and effect and so forth. So, you know, it's not going to make it to your social psychology textbook, for example, because it's just a lot of correlations, probably.
My suspicion is that this is because we don't have a good definition of love. And we do have a pretty good definition of compassion. But love in our culture is generally meant, you know, is the word is used, I sometimes joke, it's used on your romantic partner, your kid, and gluten-free snickerdoodles. Yeah. It's like we... For me as a storyteller, I see that as an opportunity. but if I was a scientist, it would drive me fucking crazy.
Well, listen, actually, there's actually a large literature on love, not self-love, on love. But again, I use this as an example. I am a co-author on a social psychology textbook. Like if you picked up a textbook, like the early textbooks in social psychology, in the chapter on relationships, you're going to have these theories about love, and they're typologies, okay? Like companion love, passionate love, you know, whatever. Totally fine researchers, if anyone out there is listening, but it's not in our textbook anymore. The close relationships literature got a lot more rigorous near when I was finishing up graduate school, like in the 2000s and beyond. And it supplanted just these typologies, which are really descriptive. Nothing wrong with that. And they probably resonate a lot. Like the kind of love I feel for my best friend is not the same kind of love I feel for my kids. Okay. I get that. Everyone gets that. But there's not, what do you do with that? What do you correlate it with what? A whole bunch of stuff. And look, they're correlated. Then now what? What do we do? What do we do? I don't know how far it's really gone. And it's not in the journals that I'm reading often or seeking to publish in. But, you know, there was and probably still is a lot of love. I'm just not tracking it. But it's not self-love, I don't think, that I'm aware of. You know, to be fair, there is, I mean, love. I mean, we're social psychologists. We care. That's something we should care about. Yeah. But it's a hard construct. Everybody defines it a little bit differently. It's slippery. And it's woo-woo. It's a little woo-woo.
Yeah, I would. And again, I don't have a research agenda here, but as a storyteller works kind of in the sphere of public health, mental health, I would like to get people to think about love in a more holistic, capacious manner and see that it isn't just your romantic relationships. It's everything from your romantic relationships to family relationships to friendships to work to micro interactions, you know, people you interact with that you don't know that well, to your relationship to yourself, and that these are skills worth developing, and that the literature shows, from what I can tell, that people with the best relationships are the healthiest, live the longest, and are the happiest. So that's my thrust.
Yeah, no, I mean, Dan, I'm joking aside, like I am really going to think about this. I think that's really interesting. It's absurd that there isn't more in some ways, or that I'm aware of, because it's everything. And we all believe that. It's about survival. You know, it's biological, all of this. And also love is biological too. But I guess it's been slippery. I'd love to talk. I have friends who have been in the close relationships field for a long time. I've won my department. I'm going to pick his ear. Maybe you've heard of him, Art Aaron. He's the one that developed that 37 questions test to get to know people. That's about forging connections. Anyway, he's known for this, but also for many other things in the close relationships literature. I'm going to ask him. I'm going to mention this to him and see what he says. Yeah, he's been around a long time. Yeah.
You also mentioned authenticity. Jennifer Egan is a great novelist that came on the show a while ago. We were talking about realness, authenticity, and she made a great point because people talk about it all the time. Just be yourself, be real, keep it real. Or authenticity is just a word. It's a kind of become jargon. And she said, we fetishize it because it's so rare. And so I just would be curious, what do you mean as a rigorous person by authenticity? And what would the connection be to self-compassion?
She thinks it's so rare. I'd love to hear more about why she thinks that. I mean, that's problematic and worrisome. Not that she thinks that, but if that were true, look, it's a complicated field and I'm in it. You know, there's conferences on authenticity. There's a chapter I need to write a whole volume on authenticity. And so forth. So, but I am a little bit strategic in how I study authenticity in that I try to stay away from all the debates about whether there is a capital T true self, because again, I come from a scientific or scholarly perspective. I don't really know or want to debate people about whether there's a capital T true self. I don't even know what that means. Is it one that's validated by other people? I don't know. But it's my subjective sense of authenticity, my subjective sense of being genuine and comfortable in my own skin. That's what I mean by authenticity. That's what I mean. It's about answering in a really highly favorable way. I feel very authentic today. Okay. I mean, it's just really the face of it, what it looks like to you, to each individual. So that's what I study. And it doesn't require that you have to say exactly what's on your mind, okay? When your mother-in-law gives you a gift you do not like, being authentic doesn't require you to say, I hate this and you should know that. Okay. That's not what authenticity is about. It's about, because you could be being true to yourself, so to speak, because it matters to you, this relationship. So you're going to do the correct thing and say, thank you so much. I love it or whatever. It's again, it's this subjective sense, your own calculation of whether you're being authentic or not. And I'm not alone in taking this approach to setting authenticity at all. At all. It's not like Serena trying to do something really convenient. You know, many people take this sort of subjective approach to understanding what authenticity is and looking at what encourages it and looking at typically positive consequences of being authentic.
How would self-compassion help in this genuineness?
Yeah. Oh, I love this. And we have a paper, you know, looking at this. In just sort of regular language, I mean, self-compassion, treating yourself with kindness, with non-judgment, okay? This is creating an atmosphere for yourself that feels safe. You know, it's not the end of the world to have these flaws and shortcomings. And part of being authentic is that mindfulness, right? Acknowledging who you are, your warts and your strengths, and self-compassion encourages that, which allows you or to feel safe enough to go ahead and be yourself, so to speak, okay? Because everybody has shortcomings, okay? And it's not the end of the world to have shortcomings. You can feel bad about it, but you know what? You're not alone. And you're not judging yourself. You're not judging yourself about it. You're being kind to yourself. So in that environment, it just feels safer. Just like if somebody were to treat you that way, you would feel safe around them. Oh, this is a friend I can feel safe with. I can admit my vulnerabilities too. But here, it's yourself providing that safety when you're self-compassionate. And it just makes sense in that environment, more willing to just take a deep breath. You know, what is it? Take our masks off and just be who we want to be. Take that risk, so to speak, which, you know, being our true selves often feels like it comes with this big risk. What if they think I'm a loser? What if they laugh at me? I've got a middle schooler teenage daughter. Wow, do I know about those risks, okay? And boy, do I wish there could be more, more risk-taking on the authenticity realm for her. So self-compassion, you know, hey, everyone's going through this. You know, I can take this risk. It's okay. That's how I think in sort of, you know, lay language, how I think self-compassion helps with authenticity.
Before we go further into your research, can you describe some of the practices of self-compassion for folks who might want to try this in their own lives?
Yeah. Well, there's certainly great resources on the internet, are very simple practices, and I'll give a couple examples. And then there are these workshops, intervention programs, 3, 6, 8 week kind of programs, some of which, you know, Kristen Neff has developed with colleagues and so forth. But I am more into the everyday kinds of things one could practice that with practice could become habitual. And it is not rocket scientists because, you know what, most of us are really good at being compassionate toward a friend. It's no problem. We're pretty good at it. Most of us. I know, not all of us, but most of us. Oh, can you just be nice to so-and-so, your friend? You don't even need to be told. Your friend is upset about something. You're nice. You show compassion. And it's really just about directing that toward yourself. And if it helps to put yourself in a third-person perspective and say, Serena, you know, pretending you're a friend talking to yourself, so be it. And this could be all just in your head. You know, taking a self-compassion break, you know, the term some people like to use, pause, maybe go through the different elements of self-compassion or whichever one speaks to you the most. Like, for example, common humanity speaks really particularly strongly to me. So when I practice self-compassion or when I try to nudge my children to, that's the one I feel like resonates with them. Everybody makes mistakes. Come on. Okay. You know, you're not alone at all in this. So it could involve just mental exercises, going through self-kindness, recognizing the negativity, recognizing you're not alone. Okay. Taking literally, it could be as quick as 3 minutes or 1 minute. Some people, it's more effective if you write it out. You might write yourself, you know, hey, how would you respond to a friend if they came to you feeling really negatively about themselves and about the situation they're confronting? They just ended their 3-year relationship. Write to yourself about this. For some people, that's better. You know, not unlike a gratitude journal, you might have a self-compassion journal where you write your sort of commit yourself to these different elements of self-compassion. I am working right now with a clinical psychology graduate student who is looking at something that's out there in the literature already, compassionate self-touch. So, you know, this is something Chris and Neff and others also talk about. You know, it could be hugging yourself like you would hug a friend. If you wanted a sort of more rigorous, you know, soothing yourself, you might put a hand over your heart. So others and we are looking at, this is a 20-second exercise, okay? It should be accompanied, ideally, with these self-compassionate thoughts. But if you try this, there is something really soothing about it, just like when you receive a hug or a gentle touch from a friend or something like that. Except here, because we're talking about self-compassion, you're doing it to yourself. And it's such a simple thing that you can do even while having a conversation with someone if you're spiraling inside your head. So these are all simple little self-compassion exercises that don't take a lot of time. They don't take monetary resources or needing to sign up for a workshop, but they do take practice, right? I mean, anything that you want to get good at and become automatic, not laborious, a default, so to speak, you got to practice, right? Just like you want to have a good three-point shot, you got to practice it. If you want it to become the default, like you can always get it, well, you got to practice this particular habit too. But they're not hard, they're accessible. And that excites me, how accessible it could be to get better at this.
What do we know about the impact of compassionate self-touch? I will say this was the thing that I bumped on the most. I remember my first interview with Kristen Neff. I mean, it must have been like 2010 or something like that. And she was talking, she was trying to get me to hug myself or whatever. And I was like, no fucking way. This is ridiculous.
I would have said that back then, but would you say it now?
No. I gave a whole TED talk not long ago where I told people, put your hand on your heart and talk to yourself the way you would talk to a friend.
Yes.
It is astonishingly helpful. It's embarrassingly helpful. I can't believe how well it works. That's my self-report. What do we know from the data?
Yeah. So you know what? Where I thought you were going, what I can't help but think about is the biology behind it. You know, I can't help but think there are biological things happening that are helping you cope with the negativity, I believe. And my colleague, who you know probably, I think he's probably been on the show, Dacher Keltner.
Oh, yeah. I love that guy.
Yeah, he's like my big brother. He, you know, he's really interested in touch and has data on it, not in relation to self-compassion necessarily, but for example, the communicative power of touch, right? Which intuitively we believe, we know there's okay touch and there's not okay touch, for example. But the data that I know about in terms of its, you know, as a self-compassion tool, and this is a paper that we're working on and is close to getting accepted, is showing that training people once with this, it's a very simple exercise, and then asking them to practice it over the course of a month. Among those who do practice this daily, again, it doesn't take long, and paired with self-compassionate thoughts, it's paired with reductions in stress, for example. Of course, it's paired with higher self-compassion reports at the end of the month, the 28 days, and it's correlated with lower psychopathology, for example, like depression. So this is just one study. I think the literature is a little bit messy still. I think there are some studies that find positive results, some don't find any results. I would be surprised if there are studies that find negative results. And so negative results here would be no results or something like that. So I don't think there's a ton on self-touch per se that isolates self-touch, compassionate self-touch and its effects. But I think it's a really promising area of research, and we're trying to contribute to it in part because it's such an easily accessible kind of practice. Doesn't involve even a pencil or paper, right? But I don't know if you were intimating about biology or what's going on. I don't know. There might be stuff out there, but I don't know it.
I believe I've heard Kristen say that it activates the mammalian care system. I don't even know what those words actually mean, but I like the sound of it.
Yeah, so she's talking about hormonal changes like oxytocin, or she's talking about vagus nerve differences and so forth, things like that. But I don't know it in detail enough to tell you. I mean, that term, mammalian, she could mean a whole bunch of different things by that.
Coming up, Serena talks about how self-compassion influences your desire for self-improvement, how it can lead you to be more understanding of other people, the connection between self-compassion and leadership, and how self-compassion can apply to parenting.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/happier. Just go to Indeed.com/happier right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/happier. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Audible lets you enjoy all your audio entertainment in one app. You will always find the best of what you love or something new to discover. They offer an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers and new releases to celebrity memoirs, mysteries and thrillers, motivation, wellness, business, and more. What I've been checking out recently is called Our Share of Night. It's technically, I guess, a horror, but it's definitely literature. I mean, it's incredibly well written, absolutely fascinating. And it really does rhyme with some of the themes that we explore on this show. I highly recommend it, although I'm only through the first 15-20% of it, but already I highly recommend it. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/10%. Or text 10% to 500-500. That's audible.com/10%. Or text 10% to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. audible.com/10%.
Let me steer you on to terra firma for you personally. Let's talk about what your research has shown about the benefits and impacts of self-compassion. I'd love to hear briefly about some of the experiments you've run and what the results are. One area I know you've looked at is the impact of self-compassion on a growth mindset. So maybe you could tell us what the experiments have looked like, what you've found, and it would be helpful probably for some of us to define a growth mindset.
Yeah. Can I actually frame that a little bit more broader?
Of course.
Yes, we've looked at growth mindset for sure, but growth mindset is, I see it as one sign or one index of the desire to improve the self, to learn and to grow. I mean, that's what a growth mindset is. A growth mindset is the belief that people's attributes and abilities are not set in stone. You're not just born with a particular hand in life, that there's things you can do, strategies, things you can learn to better your hand, that is to improve in your attributes and abilities. That's what a growth mindset means specifically, and there's an enormous literature on that. But we think of it as just one way to measure or one way to get at people's desire to improve themselves. And this is often contrasted with the desire to improve the self with the desire to enhance the self. People like to be viewed favorably. People like to get positive evaluations. I like them. I'm sure you like them. But, you know, it is not mutually exclusive with also wanting to get better, to improve the self. That's sort of my first foray into doing work on self-compassion, to look at how it influences the desire to improve the self. And one of the reasons we looked at that was because when people hear about self-compassion, they often, or they did often, have the same reaction I had, which is that that sounds really luxurious and really maybe not conducive to learning and growth to be self-compassionate to yourself, because it has this flavor of, oh, you know, this negative thing happened to you. You failed the test or whatever. Don't worry about it. It has this flavor of potentially like letting people off the hook, you know, as if it has nothing to do with them. And that worried me. And that, you know, bugs people when they hear about self-compassion. I'm sure it still bugs a lot of people. And so we wanted to tackle the opposite notion and demonstrate the opposite possibility that actually self-compassion, rather than decreasing the desire for people to improve themselves, to be complacent or lazy even, because, oh, whatever, everyone has mistakes, or, you know, don't worry about it, you know, not a big deal. It actually motivates people to, why? I'm going to do better next time. I'm going to learn from this. I'm not going to worry about being seen favorably. I'm not going to perseverate about everyone thinking I'm awesome. I'm going to focus on how I can do better next time. And so in this paper published over a decade ago now, we showed using a bunch of different ways to measure self-improvement. We assessed either people who score highly in self-compassion in a trait or dispositional sense. So these are people who walk around pretty high. They're pretty highly self-compassionate. That's their default response. Or we nudged people. We experimentally manipulated. We got them momentarily in the lab to view something negative about themselves in a self-compassionate way. And we showed across all these different studies evidence that, look what happens when you have self-compassion. You actually get people, for example, to talk about their personal weaknesses, spontaneously using growth mindset language to talk about their personal weaknesses, to sort of say, hey, that's okay. I can do better. You know, so conveying the belief that attributes and abilities aren't set in stone, that they can actually do better. That's one study showing their spontaneous descriptions of their personal weaknesses, their connoting growth mindset beliefs. We showed that people are more likely to persist after a failure on a subsequent task if they're induced to feel self-compassionate. And persistence, task persistence, has been a longstanding way to measure self-improvement. If you don't care about improving the self, you're not going to persist and try to get better on a subsequent task that is similar to the one you just failed. Okay. So people, for example, who have growth mindset beliefs, when they fail a task, they want to do it again because they want to study for it because they want to do better. If you don't have a growth mindset, you're not interested in self-improvement. For example, you're feeling like you got to protect the self. You can avoid that test, you know, or you're going to derogate that test. You're not going to persist. So we show that if you nudge people to be self-compassionate after they failed on a test that was some version of a GRE we created for them that was designed to be really difficult, so everybody failed. We got some people to think in a more self-compassionate way. Others, actually, we had them think about how great they are, sort of a self-esteem control condition. And guess who studies harder for the next test that they have to take that's like the one they took? You know, study X seconds longer, 30 seconds, a minute longer. The self-compassionate folks do versus the self-esteem people do. So just two examples. I'm just going to give you one more because I like this study. It's sort of subtle measure of self-improvement. You nudge people to be self-compassionate, or you nudge them to feel good about themselves, self-esteem, and then you give them the opportunity to interact with another person. So they're being self-compassionate or thinking about how great they are in relation to a personal weakness. Again, that's when self-compassion is relevant, when you're thinking about something negative about yourself. And then you're being given the option to hang out with somebody else. And these options include somebody who has that same personal weakness you do, but has overcome it. Somebody, you're told, has that personal weakness, so sort of neutral. Or somebody who has that personal weakness that you have, but a much worse version of it. And we know from a huge literature, established literature, that when you're wanting to feel good about yourself, you want to hang out with and compare yourself to someone who's worse off than you are. So you want to, what we call a downward social comparison, you want to hang out with that person who has that weakness that's worse than yours because it makes you feel better. You know, it's like, hey, I got a B plus, but at least I didn't get a C. Okay, that kind of thing. It makes you feel better. But when you want to improve the self, you want to shoot upward. You want to hang out with that person who has that personal weakness and is finding ways to overcome it. It's a little bit threatening because you have it and you haven't overcome it, and they have. But if you're in a growth mindset, in a self-improvement mindset, that's who you want to hang out with. And lo and behold, that's what we find using this more subtle measure. There's no mention of comparison talk. We're just like, who do you want to hang out with? You know, and people are choosing in greater proportion the upward comparison versus the downward comparison, when so often people typically want to be around people who are worse off than they are, right? Because it makes you feel better. Totally human to want that, but not when you nudge people to feel self-compassionate. So that's just, you know, a few examples from that first paper. But since then, we've shown this desire for self-improvement in a variety of other studies in relation to regrets people have, in relation to romantic breakups. Highly trait self-compassionate people, or people you nudge in some way to be self-compassionate, they want to learn from their regrets. They want to make sure they do better in their next relationship, okay? They don't want to commit the same mistakes. They face the negativity that this is a regret I have. I'm not happy about it. I wish it hadn't happened. I wish I hadn't done that. I wish I had done something, depending on the nature of the regret. Or, look, this romantic breakup, it's my fault. I'm facing it, okay? And instead of derogating that person or making excuses, self-compassionate people, they want to do better in their next relationship. Okay, so we've shown it in all different kinds of domains that contrary to any sense that self-compassion makes people lazy or complacent, it actually makes people more interested in learning and growing. And that's exciting to us. That's exciting. These are not heavy-handed nudges. Okay, they're nudges. And people are showing these more, I would say, adaptive responses to setbacks and failures. That was a lot of talking. I know. Sorry about that. But it's exciting to me. Yeah. No,
it was great. And it's fun to listen to you talk about this because you clearly are excited. And it, as a researcher, I'm sure it's fun to get clear results and also results that help other people lead happier lives.
Yeah.
One of the things I believe you found might be surprising to people who are new to self-compassion. You know, a cursory glance at the subject might seem to indicate that, okay, fine, you're having a better relationship with yourself, but it could fall into the bucket of navel gazing. But what I believe you've demonstrated is that having more compassion for your own foibles and weaknesses leads to more understanding of other people.
Yeah, this is such a fun work. And I really want to give credit to a former student of mine who's now a tenured professor at the University of Memphis, Jiawei Zhang. So much of this work has been done with him in recent years, including the study or the set of studies that you're talking about. So much of the literature on self-compassion, the scientific literature, then, you know, whatever it was, 7 years ago, 6 years ago, and still now, has really focused on, hey, self-compassion is good for you. So I'm going to use jargon, has intrapersonal benefits, like within me, it's good for me. That's great. Self-compassion is good for the person practicing self-compassion. So in the set of studies that you're referring to, we were interested in looking at the interpersonal benefits of self-compassion. What does me treating myself compassionately have to do with how I interact with and treat other people? You know, I am interested in that, right? I'm interested in whether its benefits, self-compassion, extend beyond the person engaging in it. And, you know, this is not rocket science. It's very intuitive. And I don't have to use jargon to explain what we found here, which is that, hey, you know, self-compassion makes you more open to acknowledging and accepting of your own flaws and shortcomings. That's by definition. Hey, look, I'm really not good at that. I'm accepting that. I'm going to try to get better at that. So you have this sense of self-acceptance. That's very well established, that self-compassion boosts self-acceptance. But what that also does when you sort of are accepting of your own flaws and shortcomings, it makes you more prone to be accepting of other people's shortcomings. And we've shown it's not just close others who you could say you have a motivation to think favorably of, you know, oh, my romantic partner or my kid, their flaws, you know, I'm very accepting of them. They're fine. They're great. We've also shown it extends to acquaintances, people you don't even know that well. So it's not as if it's just something reserved for your inner circle. That self-compassion, whether we're measuring it as you're just a highly dispositionally self-compassionate person, or we're, again, nudging you experimentally to be self-compassionate, you're more accepting of your flaws and shortcomings, and that spreads to both close others and acquaintances. But probably the most exciting study in that set of studies is the last one, where we brought in both participants, we call them, right, research subjects, and also were in contact with their romantic partners. Okay. So both participants and their romantic partners filled out questionnaires about their own personal flaw they have. And they also rated or filled out items about their partner's flaw. And they also indicated how they felt their partners viewed their own flaw. So in English, what we found was that self-compassion is associated not only with being accepting of my own flaw, but also my partner's flaw. Okay, and this happens for both partners, all directions. But the most important finding, I think, those are important to me too, but is that the partner feels accepted to the degree you're high in self-compassion. So to the degree I'm high in self-compassion, not only am I accepting my own flaw and my partner's flaws more, but my partner picks that up. Feels it. And that's huge, right? I mean, I could be all accepting all by myself, but my partner doesn't feel that way. It's not going to have relational benefits. Now, we didn't measure, for example, relationship outcomes like the longevity of the relationship. We didn't, okay? But it's good to feel that your partner accepts you, okay? I'm going to, you know, go on a limb there, that that's a good thing. And I just love that study because, of course, you have, you know, both partners in there talking. It's not all just in my head. My partner is feeling my acceptance of their flaw, which bodes very well for the relationship. So self-compassion is spreading to have interpersonal benefits and self-benefits, as much research has shown.
This may be obvious, but what do you think the mechanism is? As I become more self-compassionate, I'm more compassionate toward other people. How would you describe that mechanism?
Mechanism is always an important question in our research, and we don't always get at it. We first establish it, but I think the mechanism is not complicated here. I think it has to do with a bit of common humanity going on. Hey, I got this flaw. I'm accepting it. And everyone has flaws. So I'm going to be more open to your flaws as well. It's a mindset that leaks to other people. It's that simple. Did we measure that exactly? No, we measured how much my acceptance of my own flaw predicts my acceptance of your flaw. What is the exact mechanism or mechanisms that creates that link? I think could be as simple as I'm sort of recognizing everyone's got flaws. I mean, that's what's helped me accept my own. So I'm going to accept it of other people. It's, you know, with that mindfulness paired there too, you're stepping back and sort of saying, okay, let's just be generous about other people. I'm being generous toward myself. It only makes sense to be generous toward other people as well. The same sort of mindset being applied to other people's flaws and shortcomings.
Yeah, I mean, that tracks with how I experience it, which is like the more friendly I become toward my own weaknesses, ugliness, et cetera, you just inexorably leads you to understand that everybody else has their shit too.
I mean, hopefully. I mean, it's almost like, you know, if there's a level of empathy here. We've never measured that kind of thing, but you get it more. You're sitting there recognizing your flaw. They got a flaw too. And you're sort of empathizing. Yeah. Okay. We all got flaws. It's going to be fine. You know, that's okay. You're human. I'm human. We're all human. Yes. So I think it could be as simple as that.
Another area I believe you've studied is leadership. So what can you say about the impact of self compassion on one's ability to be a good leader.
Yeah. You know, I haven't studied it directly. I've definitely put pieces together from other people's work. You know, I teach in our executive education program, so it's a lot of times it's women leaders, and it's just, it's fun to bring sort of these soft skills into the workplace, which is, you know, not my typical area of expertise. So their leadership, it matters a lot. You know, authentic leadership is talked about so much in that world. So I've pieced together things, but, you know, self-compassion and its effects on making you more improvement oriented, when leaders show that kind of behavior, first of all, I think it serves as a role model for others, because part of self-compassion and part of being more inclined to improve is acknowledging your mistakes. And leaders who acknowledge their mistakes, who are willing to acknowledge their mistakes, this communicates to their subordinates that this, it's a safe place to do that. Oh, they acknowledge their mistakes, so I can too. So your self-compassion induced tendency to want to improve yourself and see yourself warts and all has an impact on those who follow you. And the data show that leaders who have a growth mindset, and again, self-compassion is something that nudges people toward having a stronger growth mindset, they treat their subordinates in a different way. For example, they are more inclined to track the ups and downs of their subordinates' performance, presumably instead of writing them off. For example, when they do poorly, if you don't have a growth mindset and you sort of believe people's abilities and attributes are just what they are, there's not much you can do about it. When someone does badly, you might just write them off and look them over for promotions. But if you have a growth mindset as a leader or a manager, you're more likely to recognize that there are ups and downs in people's performance because you believe that growth is possible, that improvement is possible. You're going to be more likely to invest your time in these subordinates to give them the chance, to give them strategies on how to improve and so forth. And the data show, again, not my data, but other people's data show that when you act this way towards subordinates, they notice. Like, people can pick up. If you ask employees at a company to rate whether their managers or leaders are growth mindset oriented, they can do that with a decent degree of accuracy. It shows. Okay. And that's good for everyone. It's a win-win. And it's a win for the company too, right? Because people feel more motivated to improve themselves. And all of this, I would argue, is more likely to happen to the degree those leaders are practicing self-compassion, because self-compassion is making it safe for yourself to acknowledge your, you know, weaknesses, to have that growth mindset for yourself, and then to have it leak over to how you view and treat your employees and so forth.
Is there another aspect of your research that you want to talk about that we haven't gotten to?
Yeah, I love the idea that self-compassion is relatively easy to learn how to do, even though it does take practice, like so much does, to get good at it. And I'm really interested, one, as a parent, I'm very cognizant of wanting to model self-compassion for my children, particularly my daughter, you know, who's at a stage in life where there's a lot of self-critical talk going on. So I'm interested in learning more about self-compassion and parenting, both for the parent, but also how it can get communicated and influence the children. And then another area that I'm really interested in and have started work on is looking at how self-compassion might be applied to the educational realm. In particular, interested in how self-compassion might be used as a tool to boost student engagement in the classroom, which, you know, has really taken a hit probably even before the pandemic, but is really salient to us post-pandemic. And I mean, like, really concrete things like, well, showing up for class. I don't actually mean that. I mean, once you get to class, how much you participate, how much you ask questions, how much you seek help. These are sort of engagement-related academic behaviors that are associated with, guess what, doing better in school. And these are at, you know, record lows potentially, okay, right now in K through 12 and college classrooms. And as we all know intuitively, and the data also show, a lot of times people don't participate in class or don't ask for help because they're afraid of how they're going to look. Okay, fear of being negatively evaluated by other people, fear of how they're going to look dumb, and or they don't feel a sense of belonging. You know, like, who are these people? I'm too afraid. I don't belong here. And guess what? Those two things, those fears you have of being negatively evaluated, the sense of not being connected to others, self-compassion can tackle those things, okay? We already know that. And self-compassion is related to self-improvement, which is related to asking questions, seeking help. Like, how am I going to get better? Why am I going to go ask for help? So we've started looking at this notion that self-compassion, because it hits at those psychological tendencies, it can in turn maybe increase engagement-related academic behaviors like raising my hand, go ahead and saying what you think in the classroom discussion. That can, one, not only make learning more enjoyable, but also you do better in school. A lot of these fears of being negatively evaluated, these deficits in feeling belonging, you know, a lot of times it's people from marginalized backgrounds that feel this way, you know? And so in some ways, I hope it works for everybody, self-compassion, and encourages engagement for everybody. But boy, wouldn't that be great if it helped people who particularly struggle with worrying about how they're going to be evaluated in an environment in which they might not feel like they belong. That's exciting to me. And it seems pretty reasonable, you know, as something that could help some students. Yeah.
A friend of mine's, her highest form of praise is to call something not ludicrous. So,
Yeah. Anyway, that's the future. And I am interested in the self-touching idea. This is, again, a student in the clinical psychology program who is spearheading this, Eli Sussman. And yeah, it's delightful to be learning about that kind of work, which I hadn't before.
Well, when you've got more results, come back and we'll talk about them.
Yes, sounds fun.
If people want to learn more about you, how can they do that?
I have a website. I have a self-identity and relationships lab. You can just find me on the UC Berkeley psychology website, and there'll be a link to my lab. And all my papers are available there for academic purposes. You can download them, et cetera.
This was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for taking the time to do it.
Yeah, no problem. It was a pleasure.
Thanks again to Dr. Serena Chen. We made a few mentions to Dr. Kristen Neff in this episode. I've put some links to my previous conversations with Kristen in the show notes if you want to go back and check those out. Hey, don't forget, I do a weekly newsletter in which I talk about the most important learnings for me from the show. And I also list a bunch of stuff that I'm really interested in, cultural recommendations, TV shows, books, music, little clips I find on TikTok. It's fun. It's a quick read. The goal is that it will be both quick and amusing and useful. Go check it out. You can sign up on my website, danharris.com. Finally, I want to thank everybody who works so hard on this show. Our producers are Lauren Smith and Tara Anderson, and we get additional production support from Colin Lester Fleming, Isabel Hibbard, Caroline Keenan, and Wanbo Wu. Marissa Schneiderman is our senior producer. Kevin O'Connell is our director of audio and post-production. DJ Kashmir is our managing producer. And Nick Thorburn of the band Islands wrote our theme. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me,
DJ Fu,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondry and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondry app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondry Plus in the Wondry app or Wondry Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.